Welcome today to our interview series of Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Yasas Abewikrama, a global top young business IT professional, entrepreneur, and author. Now, Yasas, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It's great to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Now, Yasas, I've been looking over your background. It's just simply amazing. You've done so much. So can you overview what you consider to be your top three major successes and some useful lessons you've learned from each role?
Sure. I mean, I've had a fairly long career in one way, and in another way, it's a short career as well. I'm still fairly young. I've had a career of about 10 years. And through this period, I've started my career as a software engineer initially, and then moved into business analysis, and then into consulting in IT, and then into kind of project management, and then later I actually started a business as an entrepreneur. So it's a long story in that way, a software engineer becoming an entrepreneur. And along the way, I've written books, and written a couple of columns, and then became a trainer as well, like a lecturer or a trainer as well. So I've done quite a few things. So if you ask me the three major successes, it's a bit hard question because I've done quite a few things, and I love almost all of that. But just for the purpose of enlightening our audiences, the three major successes. One, I believe, is moving from software engineering or programming into a business analysis role was one of the successes in my career, because I felt when I was a programmer or software engineer, I was only dealing with a part of ICT industry, the technological aspects of it. But I wanted to be more on the business sides of it and understanding requirements of users, understanding business needs of IT. So I transitioned into a business IT professional at a very early stage in my career. Although I have a technical degree in computer science, I actually transformed myself well into a business IT role. So that's probably the first success I have. If I am to note down. The second, I think, is I actually had the opportunity to work in multiple countries. I started my career from my home country, Sri Lanka, but I then traveled to our client locations in the US and the UK, and I also later migrated to Australia. And I actually had the opportunity to work with people in the US, UK, and Australia, and also in Malaysia, Singapore, a bit of India, everywhere. So the second achievement I would say I had is working with and dealing with people from various backgrounds, various countries, various nationalities, various walks of life, and being able to deal with them successfully in a positive manner, understanding them and being empathetic. You know, the most important thing being a business IT professional is to listen to your customer, listen to your client, and understand where they come from. And when you deal with multiple cultures, different accents, different languages, different backgrounds, it becomes even harder. And I feel I actually managed to deal with that in my different roles, especially as a business analyst and later as a consultant as well. So that's probably the second thing that I achieved. The third one I would note is the opportunity I had to start a business once I came back to Sri Lanka. I thought I've had a career now. I've been working for a couple of companies, including Accenture, which is one of the biggest consulting IT firms in the world. I thought I should actually start my own business, which I did with the help of my business partner and long-time friend. And that's probably the third achievement or the third success story in my career. If I look at it, it actually changed me from a professional into a more entrepreneurial person. And we've been talking about it for a while, but I actually managed to do it. So those three are key things in my life in career. And lessons learned, I think, kind of associated with those. One is moving from software engineering to business analysis. My lesson actually was, if you actually want to do something and you have the will, you could do it. Because at one point, some people were thinking that my technological background would actually not help in a business career. But I moved and I actually proved that it's wrong. And I did really well in a business analysis and business consulting role. So my first lesson actually is, like, if you really want to do something and you've done the planning, preparation, and have a plan to go ahead, you actually could do well. So that's my first lesson from these successes. And that lesson has helped me throughout, because now I actually believe in myself to do almost anything, because I've done something that was perceived to be difficult in a positive way. So that lesson actually helps me even today, and I believe it will help me in the future as well. And the second, I think, is the ability I developed, or the understanding I developed about people. You know, people might be of different ages or different backgrounds, different educational levels, different countries, whatever. But as long as you understand who they are and you actually talk to them in a very humane way and understand where they come from, you can deal with anyone almost. I mean, I haven't worked with a lot of people outside professional or IT circles, but within the circles that I've worked with, different nationalities, different countries, etc., I've actually learned the lesson that you could deal with almost anyone as long as you understand where they come from. The third one is an entrepreneurial learning. If you have a good business idea and a plan, and there's an opportunity to implement that successfully, as long as you work hard and also keep close to your plans. So those are the few things that I would like to highlight, Stephen. There are quite a few things I could talk to, but I think if I'm to talk about three major successes and three lessons, those are the things that I would mention.
So, yes, that's, that's an amazing sort of profile that you provided amongst the sort of the 100 things you've done, so, and then picking three of them. Can you tell us more about your current roles?
Well, my main role and the major responsibility at the moment, Stephen, is my business role. The business that we started about 4 years ago is Lanka BPO Academy, and I'm the CEO. I'm one of the founders, co-founders. I started it with my school time friend, classmate, and a long-term friend, and we are still both together in the business. So I'm the CEO. And so that's my major role. And we've had investors coming into our business. So business has actually grown into a different level with a new set of kind of processes, etc., as we have investors and shareholders involved. So that's my major responsibility, to kind of develop the business from where it is today to a new different height over the next couple of years. So that's the major responsibility. So I spend most of my time in a week on our business, Lanka BPO Academy, which is a training business for the IT and BPO industry in Sri Lanka. And secondly, I have a couple of voluntary roles. One is with the Computer Society of Sri Lanka, CSSL. CSSL happens to be an IFIP member, so we CSSL represent Sri Lanka on IFIP. So I've been on the CSSL Executive Council for quite a few years now, and currently I'm the secretary. So that's a fairly significant responsibility, to make sure the board actually runs properly. Board meets effectively, and the board records are kept accordingly. And also, in the CSSL setup, the secretary is actually responsible for our staff and the office as well. So actually, I have to look after our staff, CSSL staff, the office functioning, and all that. So my president sets the direction, and the council members are responsible for various projects, but as a secretary I am actually responsible to ensure that they get the support from the staff and the infrastructure and facilities are provided for their projects. So that's the second responsibility I have. That's a voluntary role, but at the same time I actually don't consider it that way. I've been involved in computer society activities for a long time now, and wherever I was involved, I considered it as one of my major things, and I ensure that I spend the relevant or the required number of hours on that too. So that's the second one. And third one, from very recently, about a month ago, I was appointed as the chairman of InterYIT of IFIP. InterYIT stands is the International Young ICT Group. So we represent young ICT professionals who are, roughly speaking, under 35 years across the world. So IFIP, which is the world body for computer societies, has a group for for young IT professionals, so younger people in the industry. So I actually chair all of that. So my responsibility is to ensure that young IT professionals, as well as their groups around the world, get the right support and also have the strategic direction, etc. So so as the chairman of that, I now have a new set of responsibilities as well. I'm fairly new to that. I mean, it's roughly about a month since I got it, but still in the early stages and planning activities are happening. But those are the main three things that I'm involved at the moment. Apart from that, I do write a bit. I was a freelance writer for one of the national newspapers in Sri Lanka. Recent times I've given that up because of the new role with IFIP. I thought I actually don't have enough time to write a weekly column, so I've stopped that one. But I still present a TV program, a morning show in one of the national TV stations. That's not very regular. I do about 2 or 3 days a month. Yeah, in the early mornings. So that's a small activity I do. So Lanka BPO Academy, Computer Society of Sri Lanka, and InterYIT of IFIP are the three major things that I have to deal with.
So I'm just going to ask a few additional questions with regards to those three roles, just to kind of drill into them a bit more.
Sure.
You talked about this academy that you started several years ago. Are you sort of pre-1 million or over 1 million in revenues? Are you sort of small, medium?
I would say in terms of Sri Lankan standards, we are medium size. We started as a very small company, probably two founders and about four employees, altogether about 6 people at the very beginning. Now we work with about 15 full-timers and about 20-25 part-timers. And we operate in the capital, Colombo, as well as in about 3 other districts in Sri Lanka. So we are, roughly speaking, medium-sized. And our business is a training company, basically. So we train people for the IT and the BPO industry in Sri Lanka. BPO stands for Business Process Outsourcing, which includes things like customer service, call centers, finance, and data processing. So basically, Sri Lanka is one of the newer hubs for the BPO industry in the world. India is the number one, as you may know. Philippines is one of the major players. Likewise, Sri Lanka is in the top 15 or 20, and Lanka BPO Academy is the only dedicated training provider in this industry in Sri Lanka. So we purely focus on the BPO industry, and IT happens to be one of our parts as well. So so we were the first in Sri Lanka to start BPO training, and we are today the largest and the most well-known. And even today, actually, we are the only dedicated trainer for that. So we train young people, school leavers, and train them on BPO and some IT areas, and then place them in the industry. And also we do corporate training for existing employees. So we are a major partner of most of the IT and BPO companies in Sri Lanka. And also we work close with the industry bodies and also and the industry itself. So that's the business. So it's a, I would say it's a kind of medium sized, and it started as a very small private limited company, and it's still private limited. We haven't gone public, and but we got an investment along the way, and so we have now external investors involved. Some of them are local Sri Lankan, and some of the others are foreigners or overseas investors. So as a business, like, we've gone to that level, Stephen.
I see. So I guess from a Western point of view, out in sort of North America, they may not be aware about you know some of the details of Sri Lanka. What's sort of like the population and so on?
Sure. So Sri Lanka is a fairly small country. We have, in terms of the land area, 65,000 square feet, and we have 21 million people living in this island. So we are located a little below India. It's known as the Pearl of Indian Ocean, so slightly below India. And our closest neighbor is India, and it has a tropical weather. So we don't have four seasons like winter, summer, etc. It's always roughly around 30 degrees, 27 to 32 if you like. And if you were to name the seasons, we have a rainy season and not rainy season. So it's not a seasonal country as such. It's a tropical country. We have lots of rain and lots of sunshine. And it's a beautiful part of the world, actually. In the recent past, the tourism has picked up a lot. And Sri Lanka was identified as one of the most attractive tourist destinations in a couple of world rankings or world ratings, including New York Times recently. So we are a fairly well-known tourist destination, and tourism happens to be growing at the moment. And apart from tourism, tea industry is one of the big sectors here. Sri Lanka happens to be the world's largest tea exporter, so we are big on tea. And behind the tea, we have rubber and coconut as well, and we have a lot of agricultural activities as well, like paddy fields and rice and all that. And IT BPO industry is still small, but if you rank against the large players like India, Philippines, or even Malaysia, China, we are around the mark of, say, 17th or 18th. Depends on how we look at it and depends on different ratings. But we are in the top 20 in that sense, as an outsourcing location. I mean, not comparison with Canada or US or Australia, but in comparison with other outsourced destinations like India. So that's a bit about us. It's a beautiful country. I mean, I would like to invite those who are listening to consider visiting us. Sri Lanka is a very safe country. Of course, we had a civil war in Sri Lanka for a couple of decades almost, and the war finished in 2009. And after 2009, Sri Lanka actually is considered as one of the most safest places in the world. So I would like to invite those who are listening to come and visit Sri Lanka. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth and one of the most safest places on earth today after the war. So and even I was living overseas some time back, but I came to Sri Lanka after the war finished, and quite a few other professionals, entrepreneurs actually came back. There was a bit of brain drain happening. People actually left the country for better opportunities, but since 2009, a lot of people started to come back because the war ended, and you get a lot of opportunities back home. So, Stephen, I would like to invite our listeners to consider visiting as well, if possible.
Now, your second role, you talked about the Computer Society of Sri Lanka, and you know there's this thing called IFIP, IP3. Why you? I'm just thinking, why not join IFIP, IP3?
Look, we are an active member of IFIP, and also we are an active member of SIARC, Southeast Asian Regional Computer Confederation, which represents the member societies in this region, you know, from India, Pakistan, up until Australia, New Zealand. So Sri Lanka is a very active member. We actually hosted the SIARC conference in 2013, last year, and this year, 2014, we will be attending the SIARC conference in Malaysia too. So we are actually connected internationally in that sense. With IFIP, we've had a very long relationship. Only thing is we are just starting to make it a little more active. With SIARC, we've been much more engaged than IFIP, but now we are starting to become a little more active and a little more engaged. And my role as Inter-YIT chairman, I think, would help in that, because now actually a CSSL Exco member is on the IFIP circles, and actually I actually have a seat or a vote in the General Assembly of IFIP as well. In that sense, we are starting to get engaged with IFIP. Specifically talking about IP3, we've had a couple of conversations with IP3 and studied and also learned a lot from the professionalism aspects that IP3 has to offer, and the chairman of IP3, Brenda Ainsley, happens to be one of close colleagues of some of us at CSSL. I've actually worked very closely with Brenda, and she actually is the one who took me to ACS several years ago, so she actually started my Computer Society career as well. So we have a lot of respect for Brenda and the group. So maybe in time to come, we'll see more active ways of engaging with IP3. At the moment, we haven't really nailed down the way that we could work with IP3, I guess, and that's something for us to do in the near future. But at the same time, CSSL is interested in professionalism as well as certifications, certifying our professionals on their skills and achievements, and we've now adopted the SOFIA skills framework, SFIA skills framework. So we are working with ACS at the moment, the Australian Computer Society, because ACS also has adopted SOFIA framework. So we are working in partnership with ACS to offer that certification in Sri Lanka. Actually, it was launched a few months ago, and the initial set of certifications are happening as I speak. So in that arena, there are quite a few developments happening, and I believe the relationship and active engagement with IP3 probably would happen in the near future.
Yeah, I guess it'd be actually quite a natural, because there's no fees for being a member of IFIP IP3 if you're a member of IFIP, which the society is. So it's just a matter of making I think it's about a one-page application just indicating that
sure.
You're on the journey to professionalism, and that's pretty much it. And you just indicate the officer or whoever is going to represent the organization with an IP3. There's no fees associated with it, and you're now a member of IFIP IP3. So
sure.
It sounds like it'd be a natural
for offline, after the interview, I would like to kind of have a conversation with you on engaging with IP3 and see how we could kind of partner for that. Because we are an IFIP member anyway, and if IP3 could offer some help in regards to professionalism, I think we'll be open to look at opportunities of working together.
Yeah, I guess it's the only global program out there, and you know, recently ISACA joined, and which is one of the it is the largest security audit group in the world.
Right.
They are now a full member of IP3. So, yeah, just in talking with you, I realize it's kind of a natural I also realized in talking with you as well, there's something called the Global Industry Council, which I chair and founded. And because of your role with the young IT professional group, and you're now the chair of that for IFIP, that may be a natural kind of representation in the Global Industry Council. But I can talk to you more about that offline.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Very interested.
So we've talked a lot about your current roles, and I was going to ask about the value to the audience and your goals, but I think it's pretty apparent what you're trying to do within those respective roles. So I'm going to go to this next question, and that is, what do you plan to do next after all of this?
Well, that's a bit of a difficult question. Stephen, I'm at the moment fully engaged with the Lanka Deepu Academy as its CEO and one of the shareholders. And I actually have a commitment to the investors and the shareholders, as well as the industry here and our student population. So for the next few years, I'm not really thinking anything outside Lanka BPO Academy, to be honest with you. But I want to take Lanka BPO Academy or help Lanka BPO Academy to go to the next level, with me or without me, I don't know. But at the moment, we are operational in about 3 districts outside Colombo, the capital. But I would like to see it operational in many other districts, multiple districts, and also having a bigger impact than it has today, because the industry in Sri Lanka, the IT BPO industry, is growing at around 20% year on year, and we need about 30,000 professionals in the next 3 or 4 years. And if our organization can play a major role in providing those resources for the benefit of the economy, benefit of the country, and also for the benefit of those people themselves to get jobs, I'll be one of the happiest men on the earth. So I think those are the things that are working on my mind at the moment. So I'm not really thinking of a new role per se. But I would say I have a vision to have a bigger impact through our organization and through the industry activities that we are involved. As an entrepreneur, Stephen, it's very difficult to think something outside what you are doing at the moment, to be honest with you, because once you are committed to something and you really believe in it and have the passion for it, you really want to do well. And so as an entrepreneur, that's where I am today. And I mean, I know up 5 years or so, I might have a different opinion or different vision. But for the moment, I'm really thinking of doing a better service to the society through our organization. That's what I'm thinking. But outside the BPO Academy, through CSSL, I would like to do a bigger service in terms of developing professionalism and also developing networking opportunities and also taking CSSL activities across Sri Lanka. Just like most other member societies or computer societies, we are also very much capital or the capital based. What I mean is we are also Colombo based. Colombo is our capital. And when I was with ACS, most of the activities were centered around the capitals in Australia, like Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Canberra, etc. But when you go to rural areas, there's still IT happening. And the computer societies haven't really taken their services to those people. So if CSSL could do that, and like if I could lead that or help in that or be become a contributor in that, I would be very happy.
Now, you've indicated, and I know in reading your history that you write and you're on TV and you're a media person as well. So are there any books in your future, or I guess, you're focusing on the entrepreneurship side?
No, actually, I do write very often, Stephen. Actually, it's very timely I speak to you. Last week, I actually published my second book. It's called The Catalyst. My first book came out about 8 years ago in 2006. And since then, I actually couldn't publish a book. But I've been writing a lot to newspapers, magazines, and stuff like that. But after 8 years, I actually published the second book about a week ago. I haven't actually done a public launch or the promotional campaigns haven't started yet. That will happen in a week or so. But the second book has come out. It's titled The Catalyst, and it covers about 10 areas. One is entrepreneurship. IT is another. BPO is another topic that comes inside that. Careers, education, soft skills, these sort of things are covered in the Catalyst book. So it's a kind of multi-purpose book. IT is one of the underlying things covered in it, but entrepreneurship, creativity and innovation, BPO, careers, education, number of things are covered in that book. So so that was published, and I hope to kind of promote it in Sri Lanka as well as a bit overseas if possible in the next couple of months. So that's the book that I've just published. I used to do a column, a newspaper column for a national newspaper for about 4 years. Currently, as I speak now, I haven't had much time to write for that, so this column has kind of stopped, but I still do the TV program, and that will continue. And let's see, I will definitely be writing, although I'm involved in the business and entrepreneurship activities, because writing is something that I really enjoy. I've done it for the last 10-15 years, even when I was much junior and lacked experience. I thought whatever I knew, I would write. I did that, and I would continue to write.
Now, on your book, you indicated it's going to be available in Sri Lanka. Is it going to be available online, like say through Amazon, so that the global audience can actually have access to it?
Yes, we'll make an arrangement, Stephen. What I thought was initially, actually we priced it in Sri Lankan rupees as well as in US dollars, keeping in mind that there can be a global market. Might be tiny, but there can be a small global market. So what I did was pricing we've done to suit both Sri Lanka and overseas. Initially, in promotions, I will be mentioning my email address so that people can drop me an email, and then we'll kind of handle the funds transfer in an appropriate manner through bank transfers or something like that. And I would mainly concentrate on kind of bulk orders, say 10 books or 15 books, 20 books. But at the same time, I'll look at an online mechanism as well. Last time I used a couple of online mediums, so this time I will research into that. To be honest, at the moment that hasn't been kind of looked into. The promotions are just starting for local purposes in a week or two, but I'll definitely look at international mediums as well, because today with the advancement of technology, you are anyway talking to an international audience as well. For example, if I publish something on my Facebook group or Facebook profile for that matter, I have about 1,000 friends, and out of those 1,000 people, I would say probably 300-400 people are Sri Lankan, but the majority actually are from overseas because I've worked around the world. So immediately I'm actually addressing a global market, although it's small. But it's still targeted, people who I know and people who are actually interested in me and have worked with me and have some kind of relationship with me. So in that kind of a technological environment, it's important to make sure that you keep those channels open. So I'll definitely look into that, Stephen.
So the name of the book again, can you spell it?
The Catalyst, CATALYST, Catalyst as in the person who stands for change.
Okay, so, you know, that's a kind of an interesting sort of dialogue we had on your books and so on. What are your top technology practices?
Look, in my current role and over the last 4 or 5 years, Stephen, I've actually moved out a bit from technology. I started as a programmer or a software engineer, but later on I became a business analyst, consultant, project manager, and then CEO of an organization. So along the way, I've actually kind of given up technology in that sense, you know, like I don't do programming anymore, or I don't design or architect solutions anymore in the last 4 or 5 years as a CEO of a training company, which trains people for IT industry, but still I manage most of the programs, how they are delivered, their quality, the marketing programs and all that. So in that sense, technology in real IT sense is not very applicable to me anymore.
So let's shift that question then in terms of what are your top business best practices?
Sure. Business best practices, one of the most important things that I always practice is keeping communication lines open with multiple stakeholders. I'm very big on communication and I'm a very open communicator. So in our organization, within the organization as well as with our external stakeholders, one business practice that I always try to implement is keeping communication lines open, verbal as well as email-wise, reports-wise, all that. So that's one of the business practices that I try to implement with most of the stakeholders. And the second one, a best business practice, I would say, is over the last couple of years, I've developed a love for customer service. That's one of the areas that we teach. At the same time, as an organization, I try to implement best practices around customer service, because marketing can bring sales or customers, but it is customer service that keeps your customers with you. And customer service is the thing that brings new customers through existing customers. So in that sense, it's very important to have good customer service practices, and our organization actually has that. And as a person, I am actually committed to customer service, and even though I'm the CEO, I will look into our students' or clients' problems personally, using my own personal phone. Any student, any client can directly call me, and I have implemented some of the processes around that. And the third area, I would say, is some of the marketing things that we do. Although I'm not a marketing professional, over the last 4 or 5 years, I've learned a bit. And also my business partner is also very good at this marketing. So some of the best practices that we do around direct marketing is, I would say, another best practice. We actually spend a bit on mass marketing as well, like newspaper advertisements and stuff, but we have more better best practices around direct marketing, where we directly talk to students using direct mediums. So I would say the capability that we've developed around direct reaching of customers is another best practice. So I actually don't have five really, but I would like to mention these three specifically, because actually I like to develop and make sure those are implemented. But apart from those major three that I would list on the top, we have a few other things around, you know, accounting best practices, our internal controls around certain things, and also our timetabling, quality practices in terms of making sure the students and our trainees get best and all that, are also parts of our best practices and business processes.
Now, you're a entrepreneur, so, and you've been able to build this small private company into a mid-sized company. What would be your top entrepreneurship best practices?
Right. In terms of entrepreneurship best practices, Stephen, my number one is kind of try it yourself, do it yourself, is one of the things that I kind of practice. Like we might implement a new product line or a new program, But before handing it over to other staff or your stakeholders or suppliers, I like to do it ourselves, or like within the founders, or even sometimes myself, and even some of the training programs before we give it to other lecturers or trainers, I like to do it first by myself. So, and one of the things in entrepreneurship is, as I believe, you know, might not come in textbooks, but as I believe, before you ask someone else to do something, you should know it, you should have done it, you should have experienced it, you should have failed in it, and you should have learned from it. So that's probably the best practice that I could tell young entrepreneurs coming up. Don't try to kind of outsource or give everything to staff. You have to do things by yourself. That's probably the first thing in entrepreneurship to me. The second thing is being very creative, innovative, and flexible. Because if you have a kind of a rigid mind and inflexibility, it's been difficult to succeed in entrepreneurship. So we've actually developed a lot of flexibility in terms of introducing new programs and running programs, the way we run programs, the way we run marketing campaigns, etc. So developing that level of flexibility and creativity, innovation into your own body, into your own soul, as well as into your organization is one of the key entrepreneurship things that I think any small to medium-sized companies should practice. Even a large company should do, because if you're not flexible enough, someone else will be flexible and get into your market. So even for large companies, it's important. But I think in a large company, you'd have resources to kind of take on board as contractors, consultants, etc., to make sure these things do happen. But in small and medium-sized outfits, you have to make sure, the entrepreneur has to make sure that you have that flexibility in you. So those are the two things that I would like to mention. But apart from that, keeping an open mind and making sure that you know what's happening around you is very important, because you might be working hard today on your current challenges, but you have to keep an eye on the next 5 years, 10 years as well. Because as an entrepreneur, you're not only playing a short-term game, you're actually playing a long-term game. So, of course, your day-to-day challenges are there, but at the same time, you have to keep at least one eye open towards the long-term problems, challenges, as well as opportunities. So one of the other best practices I would say for entrepreneurs is keeping an open eye towards new things happening in the industry, other ways of doing things, etc. Now, for example, in our industry, we still do most of our trainings in a face-to-face manner. Because culturally it's a bit difficult to still use a lot of e-learning and mobile learning and stuff. But I know for a fact over the next 5 to 10 years, if we don't move towards m-learning and e-learning as an organization, we might be facing challenges. So although we spend a lot of time today face-to-face lecturing, training, developing quality around that and all that, we still have to have certain processes to make sure that we actually move towards some of the technological aspects of education. So those are the few things that I would like to mention about entrepreneurship. And the other thing about entrepreneurship, I would say, maybe the fourth one in line, is keeping an eye or an understanding about the accounting and numbers. A lot of entrepreneurs, including myself, actually don't come from a numbers background or an accounting background. We come from the domain or the functional area. Now, I have a experience or a background in IT and BPO consulting, and then I started an education business in that. And my business partner is very passionate about education. So we know IT, we know BPO, we know education, but accounting or numbers or finance might not be our strength. And if you go to a travel business or a tourism business, those people are very passionate about travel or tourism or hotel sector, hospitality, but they are not accounting people. They are not numbers people. And if you go to a business in, say, e-commerce, those people are very passionate about e-commerce, websites, web development, etc. But numbers is not their game. Now, when you come to entrepreneurship, you can't say that and make that an excuse, because now you are in a business. You might be very passionate about your domain, your functional area, but still you are running a business where numbers become important. So you have to keep a very close eye, a tab on how numbers work. How many sales you had in a day, in a month, in a week, what's your sales, what's your GP, what's your NP, and all that. And I have to admit that a couple of years ago, I was not really into that sort of thing, because we were more passionate about lecturing, training, new programs, marketing campaigns, advertising, and all that, and seeing your company name going across the country. But today, I actually realize that, of course, all those are important, but at the same time, the numbers are very important. Numbers are the blood of the game, or blood of the body. So that's another entrepreneurial thing to keep in mind. And I think today we have some best practices implemented in that, in terms of making sure that we know numbers. Every day we know where our sales is, where our collection is, and where our monthly accounts are heading. So I don't claim that we are the best in that regard, because as young entrepreneurs and new people to business, we are definitely not the best yet. But it's something that we are learning, and also trying to implement as best practices as we go.
And then, what are your top tips for motivating young people, as you are the chair now of this Young IT Professionals Program for IFIP?
Sure. That's a very important question, and a question that I love, Stephen. I've worked with young people for a long time before being appointed as chairman of InterYIT, which is the international group. I was involved in Young IT in Australia. ACS, the Australian Computer Society, has a Young IT group, which is national in Australia. I initially started from its Melbourne group in Victoria. And then I actually became the national director of Young IT in Australia. And I've spoken to many young people in Australia and many school kids, many computer societies at universities, etc. So I'm very passionate in this regard. And also, because our business is a training and education business, training young people is core part of what we do. Day in, day out, every day in the morning, I meet students who are 16 years, 17 years, 20 years, 22 years. So we train them. So teaching young people, training young people, helping them is actually in the blood. So if I come to tips of motivating young people, one of the core things that I tell them is what gets you to somewhere, or allows you to achieve your objectives, is not necessarily qualifications or education. The people who have changed the world are not necessarily those who are the best qualified or the most well educated. So I sometimes take examples and tell them. For example, I take an example from Sri Lanka, where one of the most known chairmen in Sri Lanka and one of the conglomerate groups of companies actually hasn't passed his advanced level, or even doesn't have a degree, but he managed to become the chairman, and there are thousands of people working under him, and some of them actually have degrees, PhDs, masters, and all that. So the first tip that I use to motivate young people, even would use here to motivate our listening young people, is that don't really rely too much on qualifications and education. That actually adds value. But what really makes a difference is your game plan. What you want to achieve, your objectives, your goals, and very importantly, the way you outline to get there, having a plan. So you might have, say, two objectives, three objectives, and those objectives should then boil down into, say, 10 goals, And then to achieve those 10 goals, you have a set of plans. Some of them may be long-term plans and some of it could be short-term plans. So you have that set of plans and then you work towards it. Your qualifications and education might help, but at the end of the day, if you have a proper plan and a proper set of goals, underlying objectives, then you should be able to succeed. That's a very important thing. Second thing is working hard. If you take the most successful people in the world, historically, they are hard workers. If you don't work hard, it's very difficult to achieve your end objectives. I actually take some of the examples from my life, even today and even in the past. When I tell students, young people, the things that I have done and things I do, sometimes people ask, yes, actually, do you have time for all this? Like, you have a family, you have a kid, you are CEO of this, that of that, and this of this. And do you actually have time? Then I tell them, you actually have to work hard. Make sure you have a timetable. You actually plan your time properly, but at the same time, put long hours, etc. So those two are very important for young people. If you know how to manage your time and work hard, and also with my first point on having proper objectives and goals, then you could actually succeed. The third area is actually believing in yourself. A lot of young people actually don't really believe in themselves. They sometimes read stories about various entrepreneurs or successful people in the world, say Richard Branson, maybe Bill Gates. But at the same time, doubt whether they could do that, whether they could be that. But I tell young people, Richard Branson was as normal as you were or you are today. When Richard Branson started, when he was 16, 17, 18, he actually didn't have anything. When Bill Gates started, he was very normal. He even didn't complete his university degree. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook didn't have anything. He was very normal, very average, just like you. So believing in themselves is very important for a young person. Because unless you believe in yourself, others are not going to believe in you anyway. So you have to believe in yourself. I think those three, if you keep in mind, a young person can be motivated and a young person can keep their motivation levels up. And also, another thing I tell young people is about the important decisions in their life. Most critical important decisions in one's life are typically taken in the younger age, you know, from 18 to say 25, 26. For example, you decide on your higher education when you are like 18, 19, 20. So, depending on the higher education path you take, the rest of your life is actually relying on that. Whether you do hospitality at 19 years, or whether you do, let's say, IT at 19 years of age, means what you do for the next 40 years of your life. Then your career, once you have finished your studies, or finishing your studies, you will pick your first job, first area of work, or your career. And that career will mean what you do for the next 30, 40 years. And also, selecting your life partner, your wife or husband or life partner, actually happens in most people's cases in the age of 18 to 25, 26. So I tell them, think very clearly, or make it very clear to yourself that age period, 18 to 25, is very critical because you select a partner with whom you live the next, the remainder of your life. You select your career, meaning what you do in the next 30, 40 years. Decide on your higher education, means what you learn for the next couple of decades or few decades of your life. So you take major decisions in that period. After that, when you are like 30, 35 or 40, you still make major decisions, but that is within the decisions that you have already taken. You might make a job change. You might make a slight career change, but you are still working within the education that you've already had. You are still working or living with the partner you've already decided, unless you decide to change the partner. So in that sense, that age period is a critical time frame of one's life, Stephen. So I enlighten the young people about that so that they kind of are motivated to think realistically and practically about that time period, because a lot of young people don't realize how critical that time period is. And once you make them understand how critical it is, then they start to think more carefully and more thoughtfully and consciously and take decisions. And I hope these things will help to motivate a young person. Hopefully those who are young enough will take something from this. And for others, they can take this to motivate others, inspire others.
Now, the next question, and you may find it somewhat difficult, but I'm just going to get you to focus on what you would be considered to be your one top failure or challenge and the lesson learned from it.
Look, I personally don't like to consider something a failure. Of course, I've had quite a few failures, but I like to consider that as a lesson than a failure, because failures are the pillars of success as well. So rather than calling something a failure, I would like to call something a lesson. Anyway, one of the failures or the lessons in that sense is for me was when I started this Lanka Deep Sea Academy, I sometimes feel I didn't have the full depth understanding about the student market in Sri Lanka. I actually lived in Australia for 5 years before I started the business with my partner. And to some extent, I had actually lost contact with the ground, but I felt I knew enough. But looking back today, I feel I should have studied a bit more about the student market, how students behave, and certain dynamics of that market, and certain opportunities in the market as well. I'm not regretting what we did. Of course, I'm very happy, satisfied, and enjoying our journey. But I feel if I studied a bit more at the beginning, we would have done certain things differently, and picking certain market segments, picking certain product lines could have been done a little better. So that's the lesson learned in my career as an entrepreneur, and that's the lesson I could kind of transfer to those who are listening, because when you are starting a business, if you're starting a business or if you're planning to start a business, make sure that you've actually spent enough time studying the business, studying the market, understanding the market. Now, I'm one of those who like to do things. I like to talk about things, discuss about things, plan things, but I like to really get on with things and start things early. So that feature actually kind of resulted in me starting very quickly. But for a new entrepreneur, I would advise, of course, you have to start, but at the same time, spend enough time understanding the market, spending time with the market, mingling with the market, etc. But at the same time, the other advice that goes in hand is make sure that you start as well. Now, I have quite a few friends who've been talking about businesses for a number of years, but have not started. They just talk about it, plan, and then a couple of years later, the plan is actually not relevant anymore. It's out of date. So you have to make sure that you start. But at the same time, one lesson that I've learned is spend enough time studying about the market.
The next question is about controversy, but you know, there's a lot of areas of controversy. I want you to focus on what you consider to be the number one or one single area of controversy in the area that you work.
Should it be from current roles, or can it be from previous roles as well?
It could be in anything that you wish to talk about.
Right. Well, in terms of controversy, one of the things that I've faced in one of my previous roles is I worked on a consulting role, a reporting consulting role, and And I was responsible for certain reports in a major project that went into the top management. And certain controversies about the things that were reported, the scope of reporting, and the way that we agreed on things that were reported was controversial at a certain time. And I was kind of junior or kind of middle management at the time, but it was a lesson learned for me at the time to kind of provide reports, but at the same time then realize that we haven't agreed really on the content of the reports, and then became controversial. So in a reporting role, I kind of started to understand at the time different opinions of people and different perceptions of people about different matters. So that's a controversy that I faced, but at the same time, it was a lesson learned. Later on in my career, I started to become much more open in terms of communication. I mentioned one of the best business practices that I always try to implement is open communication. Now, if you don't have those open communication lines, you're not clear about expectations of different people. And this lesson that I learned quite a few years ago is still helping me in terms of controversy. So that's one of the things that I would like to mention. And apart from that, in the recent years as an entrepreneur, I haven't really faced that much of controversy, especially with having open communications and being accessible and reachable. You don't really get into much controversy now, because if there's a problem or a concern, someone can directly talk to us or discuss with us, and then you actually decide on a kind of a basis or an agreement that everyone can agree on or rely on or can support. So in that sense, in the last couple of years, to be honest, Stephen, I haven't had that much of controversy. And although I'm a media person, I don't actually get into that much of controversial topics. Most of my topics in the written media has been around IT and business IT and entrepreneurship. So I don't really get into things that are very political and stuff like that. So I haven't really faced much controversy. The television program also, we do a morning show, so it's not very political, or we don't go into that much of arguable topics in that sense. I've managed to keep myself away from too much controversy.
Now, the next question, we're going to talk about computing. Do you feel that computing should be a recognized profession on par with some of the other professions, like accounting or law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
Yes, I mean, it has to be. The difficulty is IT is everywhere. I mean, this has been discussed in different formats, different forums, rather, different times. I remember in during my time in ACS also, we were discussing how certain other professions such as accountancy, for example, are actually recognized as professions, whereas IT is not really. Now, the difficulty here is, Stephen, IT is everywhere. So someone might be in shipping, but inside shipping you have IT. Then someone might be in, let's say, hospitality, and then you have IT within hospitality, etc. So that's a difficulty. But as a professional, I believe we are a separate profession, so it has to be recognized separately, and the qualifications recognized separately as well. Now, one other challenge in this industry, though, is the transferability, if I pronounce the word correctly, transferability of skills, because someone might learn IT in India, but their clients are in Canada or US or Australia. someone might learn IT in Malaysia, but they work for Singaporean clients or Australian clients, New Zealand clients. So in that sense, it's a difficult thing in that sense as well. But I believe recognizing IT as a separate profession is important, and recognizing those qualifications across the globe is important, so that we can make sure these people can be used across the world by different countries, different companies across the world. So in that sense, I think there should be certain processes collectively to make sure that this happens. I know this topic has come about in the last 5-6 years, and IP3 and SOFIA are relevant in this discussion. I still feel, Stephen, we are in the early stages of developing a global profession, but it has to start somewhere. And I believe IP3 and IFIP could actually play a major role in that, in terms of recognizing different skills, different qualifications, professionals in different countries, but as general IT professionals for their different skills. So I think collectively as an industry, we have to get there.
Yeah, just going to make a sort of an added comment, I guess. You know, we with IP3, you have Isaka joining IP3, and I believe they have something like 130,000 members globally, and something like over 80 to 85% certified. So it's interesting that in particular domains you can have a fairly high credentialing rate, and it does indicate that, you know, there's opportunities there to professionalize all of computing. Now we're down to our last two questions, and in this next one, talking about, you know, you do a lot of speaking, traveling, and you've got a variety of high-profile roles. There must be maybe one or maybe two stories that you can share of something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing.
Right. I do a fair bit of speaking. Even our day job today is about speaking, because I lecture and train people, and sometimes I spend long hours speaking to students. Now, if I take today, I actually spoke only for about an hour because I had only one lecture. But yesterday, I actually was lecturing for 7 hours. So speaking happens to be one of the main things that I do at work. So in terms of surprising and unexpected things, I would say is one of the awards that I won is kind of was unexpected to me. A lot of people were expecting, but to me unexpected. That is the award I won in Australia, the young professional in Australia or something like that. So it was not only for IT, but across other industries as well. So there's a body called Professions Australia, and they recognize a professional of the year and a young professional of the year. So in 2009, ACS actually submitted my nomination for the young professional category, for the young professional of the year award. Now, I personally wasn't expecting anything or expecting to win it, because I actually haven't really been in Australia for a very long time. I went to Australia only in like 2006, and I actually had done my most of the studies in Sri Lanka by that time, and I was fairly new to Australia, only 3-4 years, and but those 3-4 years I had worked very hard with ACS, especially promoting young IT and was supporting young people. Amazing to some, unexpected for me, and I don't know for some others, but I actually won the award. So that was for the things that I did in like 3-4 years. So it must have looked fairly significant for them, and among a very competitive submission list or a list of candidates, I actually managed to win the award. And I was actually surprised and unexpected, but actually it's a lesson that I sometimes use here when I train students. I tell them, like, if you really do well, you will be recognized anywhere in the world. I mean, I wasn't really Australian. I really didn't live there for decades, but I actually became the young professional of the year, surpassing the Australians as well. So that's the lesson that I can use to tell young people. It's kind of unexpected in one sense, but on the other hand, it's actually tells a story that if you do well, if you work hard, and if you become a like kind of do enough service, you will be recognized anywhere in the world. So that's one of the things, unexpected things that I've done or I've faced with. Another one I would like to share is the start of my writing career, Stephen. I started to write, I mean, I've been writing since I was a schoolboy, but to public media, I started to write when I was still a university student. And a lot of my friends, colleagues at the time were not really taking it seriously. They thought it's kind of funny for me to write to national newspapers, and because I actually didn't have much experience. I was only a university student, no brand name, not much experience, no connections, no contacts, no network, nothing. But I actually didn't really bother, didn't really stop. I continued to send articles to different editors. And actually, one of the national newspapers started to pick my articles, and at the time they started to publish it, not almost weekly, but kind of say once or twice a month. And it was amusing to me and to some of my friends to see my name on paper, but that was also unexpected, but again surprising. And also it also shows that if you really want to do something, there's a way to do it. If you keep on trying, there will be opportunities. The doors will be opening. There's this famous saying, the doors will be opened to only those who knock on them. You know, if you don't knock on them, the doors won't open. So I've always kind of tried to knock on doors, even if it looks a bit kind of surprising or kind of funny. I know that it has unexpected things can happen, because I've actually faced with that. And at the same time, during this period that I'm talking about, early stages of my speaking career, I my company at the time, Virtusa, submitted my name or my nomination for an international awards competition run by CIMA, Chartered Institute of Management Accountants in the UK. Now, CIMA is actually very popular across the world. I'm not too sure whether it's very popular in Canada or US, but in some of the European countries and Commonwealth countries in the Asian region, CIMA is very popular. So I applied for one of the awards. Actually, my company submitted the nomination, and even I didn't expect. And but one of my project managers said, yes, you've done well, and your project and the quality of work is really good, so let's submit this. No one really expected, but eventually I actually won. Actually, that was the first time I went overseas outside Sri Lanka, and that was to receive this award in the UK, which was called Part Qualified of the Year, because I was part qualified in CIMA, and it was subtitled as Up and Coming Young Business Leader. So that actually gave a new momentum to my new career, or even adult life, because I was very young at the time. But these kind of unexpected things happen to people if you really do well and if you really try. Some people are there who really work hard, but they don't go that extra mile to kind of get the recognition or to tell what you do or to reach out to the society, mass society. So I think those things are very important for a professional. Especially in IT, I've met a lot of people who are really good at IT, software development, graphic designing, networking, designing, and all that. But they don't really communicate externally or communicate widely. So their skills and abilities are hidden to them and a small team of people that work with them. So my advice to people in IT is make sure that you have all the social media and various networks, communication mediums to get out what you do. If you don't tell the world what you do, they won't know, and you don't get the recognition. And it's not only you who is disadvantaged, but even your concepts are disadvantaged, because if you get a chance to communicate, you can popularize the concepts too.
Yes, so we're down to our last question, and that is, I'm turning the tables, and if you were conducting this interview, what maybe two questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Okay. Right. One question I would ask from a similar person like me is, similar in the sense, a person who's involved in multiple roles, is how to manage your professional work, business work, with your family life and personal life. That's one question that I would ask. And my answer in that case is I'm still learning. because I actually, I'm a family man too. I'm very close to my small family, my parents, my wife's parents, and a close network of relatives. And also I like to keep close contacts with my friends. And I actually have a very young son as well. He's 2 years old. So, and then it's fairly challenging to make sure that you do all this work and also you give enough time for your wife, your family, your son, and all that. So, and then I'm learning, I'm trying certain things are working, certain things are not working. But that's a question that I would pose. What are you doing to make sure that your life is balanced in that sense? That's a question that's there in IT industry as well as in other industries, and people are challenged, you know. And in certain cases, you take certain responsibilities and additional roles when you are very young. When you take additional roles when you are, say, 40, 45, 50, it's a different matter. But when you have additional roles when you are 25, 30, 35, it's a different matter. Your family is still young. You have to look after them. You are still developing your family as well. You are still trying to build your own family. So the set of challenges are different. So if you meet another person like me, I would recommend asking that question. So that would help us as well as the listeners. So that's one. The second one, Stephen, I would say one question I would ask is how are you utilizing social media for your business and professional activities, especially in terms of maintaining the profile. Now, when you come to a certain level or a certain caliber in your career, you actually become a public figure. I'm not very famous, to be honest, but at the same time, Sasa Bevikrama is not an unknown name also. If you ask people in Sri Lanka, especially Colombo, if they are reading newspapers, especially English newspapers, certain TV channels, they would know my name. Now, how to balance that, you know, how to use social media to further develop that profile, but at the same time, to keep your personal details safe and also keep your personal life safe, because at the same time, being famous, you have to make sure that you have your personal life and you have your privacy as well. So how to balance that? So you use social media to some extent to promote yourself, to get your brands across, your messages across, your concepts across, but at the same time use it effectively to kind of live in a safe way, in a private way, so your life is not really entered by unknown people too much and all that. So that's another interesting question I would ask, because some of the IT professionals that you would meet in the future might be very good at it. Now, I've noticed, for example, Mark Zuckerberg he's the inventor of Facebook, but at the same time, he's not on Facebook too much. He doesn't put too much about his personality, pictures and all that. But at the same time, his followers do that at an extreme level. Now, where to draw the line? Are we to follow Mark Zuckerberg, or are we to use his system and be very public? Now, I guess you understand my dilemma. So that's a question you could pose to someone who comes from kind of a similar background.
Well, yes, you've given us many insights through this dialogue, and I know your schedule is demanding. You're doing a lot through your writing, through your leadership of your business, and how you're working to expand it as well, with through your contributions on the global scale as chairing this new role with the Young IT Professionals group within this UNESCO-founded International Federation for Information Processing, or IFIP. So, you know, we as the audience were indeed fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and thank you for sharing many of your experiences and deep insights with our audience.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for this opportunity. And I wish IP3 all the very best for future, as well as IFIP. IFIP, of course, now I'm part of it, and I will be a stakeholder and a colleague of yours and your organization too. And I thank again to you, Stephen, for inviting me, interviewing me. And also I should thank the IP3 group, led by its chairman or chairperson, Brenda Ainsley. And I look forward to working with you in the future. And if there's anything that I could do to help your organization, your concepts, your plans in the future, I will not hesitate to do that.
Well, thank you again, Yasas, and I'm going to close by saying that I am Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Yasas Abewikrama. Yasas is a global top young business IT professional, entrepreneur, and author.